ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, Brooke Nindorf with you for The Country Hour today and for this week. Coming up, we're going to hear from some of the farmers that have been affected by those terrible fires that are still burning in Victoria at the moment. Plus also, did you end up cutting much for hay this harvest? There seems to be a lot more around this season.
Last year we ended up buying hay out of Queensland, Northern Territory, Victoria and New South Wales just to get through with a land feedlot. This year we're, pretty determined to make as much hay as we could. The season's with us and we've got enough to supply ourselves.
Let me know if you ended up cutting more hay than you thought. We'll hear from that story very shortly. But I would love to send you to send me a text on 0467 922 783 and let me know if there was a bit more hay around your place this year. But first today, Victorian fire authorities continue to battle uncontrolled blazes across the state with at least 390,000 hectares burnt so far. One person was killed in the Longwood fire near the central Victorian town of Seymour, which police confirmed yesterday afternoon. And the State Control Centre has provided the ABC with more information about where the damage from the bushfire has occurred. At this stage, the combined damage figure for the state remains at more than 300 structures. There's also been livestock, cropping land, vineyards destroyed, sheds, fences and other infrastructure, machinery also burnt, and impact assessments are continuing today and will continue over the next few weeks and months, no doubt, and these numbers are expected to rise. And you can keep up to date with those live updates online at abc.net.au. There's a live blog there that you can follow along with. But like a freight train, that's how Natamuck farmer Michael Stoodholes described the fire that smashed his property on Friday, which destroyed his family home. And Angus Verley spoke with Michael earlier this morning.
We got the fire warning and, basically 10 minutes later it was at our place and, we were fighting the front of it. And it just swirled around and took our house out and kept going. So it was just over that quick.
Yeah, so just no time at all to do anything?
No, just react. We just were out hitting the fire at the front of our house on a lentil stubble, and there's probably 4-foot flames in the side and 6-foot flames out the front, and we thought we were getting on it, but, the cloud mass above us the front there, it was carrying the embers. It just was ahead of us, and it was through the property before we knew it.
And Michael, you believe that the house was actually on fire before the front got there?
Yeah, so I was just talking to a friend that was helping us out during the fire, and we were discussing it, and we've worked out the roof had to be on fire before the front got to the house, because when we saw it, it was well alight, so the embers had to have got in the house before we realised, and the house was gone within 10 minutes. The house was destroyed.
Right, so there was nothing to be done to save it?
No, my wife was in the house, and she was very lucky to get out. The ceiling was dripping, plastic on fire on the carpet, and another minute in the house, and she might not have been with us.
How is your wife? Because that must have been just terrifying.
Oh, yeah, no, she's sort of had nightmares about it, and she's very shaken up about it, so it's very traumatic for her. She lost 4 cats in the fire, and she's blaming herself for not getting them out, but there was just no time to do anything.
That just makes it all the worse, losing family, pets.
Oh, yeah, no, devastating, devastating, yeah, yep.
So you were, your whole family was there throughout this, Michael, doing what you could to fight it?
Yes, no, my son and myself and a good friend all had a fire units each, and we thought we were pretty well prepared. But after the fire passed, you realise how inadequate we were, really. It was a horrific fire, and I've been to Grampian fires and Harrow fires, and I've seen firestorms, but for something that was out in the open and it was burning across the lentil stubbles doing 80 k's, I've never seen anything like it.
And on that point, we're not talking really about a bushfire. This is a grass fire. Did you ever believe that a grass fire could behave like that?
No. I had all the confidence that we could have, you know, held it up on the lentil stubble in front of our house if it came that way. And I never dreamt, you know, I've been involved with CFA in past years and helped, you know, do fire breaks around Nanaimo and that, and I would never believe that we would have lost Nanaimo like we have. It's something I never would have dreamt of, to come through the town and, you know, actually get, you know, buildings and houses in the main street.
And you talked about the lentil stubbles burning. Like, they're sort of meant to be almost as good as a fire break.
Oh, yes, yeah, well, you know, you expect the fire to die down and the heat to go out of it. We were getting some control on it, but the storm above us was carrying that much heat and embers and the speed, you know, it was ahead of us the whole way, and there's no way we're going to stop that. But, you know, we didn't realise that at the time. But, yeah, that's what, you know, got our house, and that's what pushed the fire through, and just, it was like a freight train. It was on its way and gone before we realised.
Where are you now, Michael?
Very good friends of us have put us, they come and collect us from the farm, and they've looked after us and got us clothes, and yeah, you see news articles where people walk away with what they're wearing, and that's basically what's happened to us. And we've had hundreds of phone calls of people offering help, and yeah, it's very emotional, and yeah, some really good friends out there.
A lot of people have said the same thing, just incredible how people pull together like that in these tough times.
Oh, definitely. And people that have been burnt themselves as well. Like, we were talking to friends yesterday that they lost their house as well, and they want to know if they can help us. And, you know, it's amazing, really.
People putting others first.
Yep. And, you know, the guy that helped us fight the fire there, a good friend of ours, and he just stuck through with us and never flinched. And, you know, he put his life at risk for us. And I'll never forget that.
What do you do now, Michael?
We had the insurance broker come and saw us yesterday and explained, you know, what that process looks like. And, yeah, it's about, you know, getting assessments, all that stuff. And then, yeah, to start the cleanup and, yeah, put one foot in front of the others, and you know, we'll rebuild and put the farm back on the map.
And a long road back for you, yeah. Your neighbours, and the whole Nanaimo community.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Look, you know, they're reporting 30 homes lost, and that's going to gutter Nanaimo. And, with all the other troubles that we've had in town, it's not what we needed. So, yes, it's going to be a battle, but it's a very strong community, and, yeah, I believe in it, and I'm sure it'll get back on its feet.
What support do you need from the government?
something to, you know, boost businesses back up and make it easier for people to get back in and, not have to, you know, we got phone calls about support, but then they want emails and all this information, and you try and explain to them that you've got nothing. Everything went up in the house. Like, I don't even have a wallet on me. Every bit of paperwork's gone. And, it takes a bit to explain it to them. So it just makes the process pretty frustrating. I think they really need to look at the big picture of these communities and do something of substance, not just talk.
Nanaimo farmer Michael Sudholes speaking with Angus Verley. Let's head to the Upper Murray now, where the Walwa fire is still burning. And Friday was a devastating day for people in Kootong, with homes lost and farms completely burnt out. Tara Brewer is a beef producer from Brewer Beef, who has properties in Tallangatta Valley, Kootong and Berengama. And she told Annie Brown they're lucky to have saved their cattle.
Wednesday last week, a bushfire started in the Mount Lawson State Park, just over the ridge from us at Kootong. And Thursday it ramped up with the bad weather and crept over closer. And then Friday, just Armageddon, basically. Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock, the winds picked up and it raced straight towards us at Kooitong. And, yeah, raged out of the state forest and over the top of us, basically.
So that's on Friday. Like, yeah, what did your Friday look like? What were you out doing and yeah, what was it like?
Yeah, so fortunately, my 16-year-old son and his grandfather had mustered all our cattle from the 2,500 acres up here and into the yards. And while we, my husband and I and other son, prepped all the pumps and got all the machinery together so we could, we decided just to defend my father-in-law's house and yards. That was the best position for us. So we, yeah, my husband and I and other son were prepping all of that to make sure that it was as clear, as defendable as possible. And then when the winds picked up at the last possible moment, the CFA strike team turned up, which we are so grateful for. And they left a truck here with us and hit the, so they could look after the house while we were looking after the cattle and the sheds. So, yeah, it was, it sort of just rolled over the top of us on both sides at the one time. So, yeah, it was pretty frightening. Just I just could not believe the speed at which everything was on fire. Fortunately we'd cut silage in the front paddock, so it was just a grass fire coming leading up to the sheds and the cattle, so we could put that out and keep that area safe. But yeah, the rest of the farmers has all burnt, all our fencing's gone. Yeah, we didn't even have one paddock to let the cattle out of the yards to put them in, so within the last couple of days we've cobbled together a small paddock that we could let them out of the yards, because that cattle were all pretty stressed about being in there together for so long. Yeah.
But you've saved all your cattle?
Yes, yep, everyone. So far we haven't been up to our Baringamar block. We're not quite sure about all of them, but from all reports, most of them are okay. So, yeah, but everything at Kooitong we saved.
That's great. And, yeah, have you been up to Kooitong since Friday and had a look?
Yeah, we've been here the whole time. We haven't been able to get out because of the power lines that are down.
Yeah.
Yeah, yesterday we were able to get out down to our other property as and get some things from there, but then the fire was impacting down at Tallangatta Valley as well. So our son's gone down there, our 19-year-old son's gone down there to look after that now. Now we could get down the road.
What's the feeling like at the moment in the Upper Murray? Like, you know, how are people feeling? You've been talking to your neighbours and everyone. It's
Everyone's pretty angry. Pretty angry. We haven't seen any of the authorities. We've had Vic Fire come and do an assessment of asset loss, and that's about it. So we haven't seen anybody to give us any help other than our beautiful friends who have managed to get us a generator. And wire it in for us. Other beautiful friends that have moved cattle for us and up at Baringamar, and but we haven't seen any official whatsoever.
Tara Brewer, a beef producer from the Tallangatta Valley, speaking to Annie Brown. And now let's go to the Western District now to a fire that blew up between Streatham and Skipton on Friday. And Chris Shady is a farmer near Skipton. He's speaking here to Emma Field.
We were in the house. It was total fire that night, roaring wind, hot, in the 40s. And my wife said, there's a fire north of Streatham. And I was half ready. Then I walked outside my house and you could just see the smoke coming and you could see where it was. It was just a monster. It was moving fast, coming straight from the north from us. And by the we're talking 10 minutes, the road would have been cut off. We couldn't make the fire, so the best we could do was protect the side. We knew it was going to come down towards us. So we were all ready to try and head it off on the Lismore-Skipton Road a little bit. And when it did hit, we tried to put it out, but it was so strong and the wind was so strong that you'd squirt the water at it and the water would come back and scald you in the face. It was just that hot. And so the best we could do was work on the edge. And we got an edge out, but it was in the stony rises. So we couldn't even get vehicles through there. So we concentrated on a a wing, and then the wind changed to the west, which, thank goodness that happened in a way, and then it took off to the west, and that's when it burnt the property I've got beyond Skipton. All you could do was work on the edges, really, and as the wind calmed down, we got on top of it. That's about all you could do.
So you've obviously been out to look at what's happened. What kind of damages are you looking at?
Probably the places that got hit from the north. It looks like an atomic bomb. Imagine that. Houses gone, infrastructure gone, no power poles for miles, so the power is going to be off out there for ages. Houses that have been there for 100-odd years, they're gone. I think estimating maybe 14 houses gone that got hit from the north. These are houses that people lived in. They weren't abandoned or anything. They weren't like a workers' cottage, so main houses, sheds, hay sheds, machinery, untold number of headers, tractors, front-end loaders, hay sheds. Just imagine a farm with nothing left. You might have a farmhouse, you might have a few sheds, that's it. Everything else gone, all fence and stock gone.
And have you been able to speak to your neighbours at all?
Yeah, we've been working, helping our neighbours who got hit worse than us, who had stock losses, etc. We're still working with them, trying to help them. I only lost a wheat crop. Yeah, there was 400 acres of wheat lost. No livestock. I only lost a wheat crop and the boundary fencing, and that bit of internal fencing.
Well, that's right, because that part of the world hasn't finished their harvest, so there'd be crops everywhere, wouldn't there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and headers out in the crops. That's why they're all burnt. And trucks and balers and, you know, all the harvest machinery you can think of, it was all out there. And it happened so quick. Like, it was down here in under an hour.
What now for you and your community, Chris?
Well, we're all helping each other, trying to take care of the stock losses. Well, that happened yesterday, mainly. For the district.
Do you have any idea how many head of livestock possibly?
I can only go on my neighbours. I don't know other people's, but, you know, it's in excess of 500 on each farm. Yeah, that's. I don't want to over-exaggerate, but, yeah, there'd be lots all up, but, yeah, my neighbour would have lost 500. There was a vet there yesterday, and my nephew was euthanising for the owner.
Just a terrible job.
Yeah. It scars you for life, that one. Some people have got no houses to go home to. I was helping a guy sawing up a tree off the road, and he'd been burnt really badly, and it was across his driveway, and I stopped to give him a hand to just move the branches, and his chainsaw went blunt. And he said, I'll just go back and sharpen the saw. And then he turns to me and he goes, I've got no shed, I've got no chainsaw, shut up, no, I can't go back to anything. Like, that's devastational when you've got nothing to go back to other than a house. And some people haven't even got that. So, very, very tough when, you know, something you take for granted, like your little shed with a few tools, but it's gone. Very, very hard for some people, it'll be.
Definitely. That was Skipton farmer Chris Shady speaking with Emma Field. And we've had a text come through from Brian. Thanks for texting in, Brian, talking about these Victorian fires that are affecting farmers and their livestock. And in particular, Brian pointing out that they'll be urgently requiring hay, and all those organisations that come to the aid will be at the fore again. And speaking of that, amid this bushfire tragedy, a massive volunteer effort has kicked into gear already to provide support and assistance to farmers whose property have been hit by fire. Aussie Hay Runners is one group that's been working to deliver support to farmers in bushfire areas. And Jared Whittaker spoke to Linda Widup, the group's founder and a beef farmer at Carlisle River in the state's southwest.
Presently at the moment, we're just receiving quite a lot of hay donations to run up to the guys here at Longwood, Ruffy, Gamalaby. We're sort of trying to get these worst affected areas. I'm just starting to get trucks to run up to Walworth for tomorrow. We've got some running into the Katamatite area, we've got a good safe depot there that can help those people. So that's where we're at the moment.
And what are you seeing on the ground?
Well, I had photos sent to me this morning from one of my drivers that was up at the Longwood area, and the farmers are just lined up. They're lined up. They're just that desperate. They're just waiting for the trucks. He said it basically went from his truck onto their trailers and they were gone. And, it, you know, the anxiety and tension's fairly high. These people have been through a pretty rough time.
And I imagine it's been quite well received.
Oh, and then some. You have no idea. It's, you know, this is a bit of a lifeline to these people because through no fault of their own, Mother Nature's thrown a ripping curveball at them, and all they want is something to give their animals. The animals are stressed. There, a lot of them have got a bit of disaster going on with injured and burnt animals, so we've got a few of our drivers coming up that will help dispatch a lot of those animals because these people are just tired. They're tired and weary. They've been out there fighting their fires and what have you. So, you know, we're just trying to help in as many ways as we possibly can.
And for any farmers that are listening and would like to access some of this hay, how can they go about it?
Okay, if they hop onto our Aussie Hay Runner Facebook page, they can get onto us there. My phone number is always is on there as well, so I'm always open to anyone ringing me. And we're just trying to get hay out to as many areas as we can, as quickly as we can. But unfortunately, like, a lot of the areas are still with live fire, so my drivers, their trucks and the hay are priority. We've got to make sure that it is safe for them to access this.
And how big's your team, and how much hay are you moving?
We started yesterday afternoon and we've got around 20 loads out so far. We have a team of 74 truck and trailer drivers, but we've also had a lot of people that have put the call out. They've got their own trucks and they're going to run on our behalf.
And it's pretty remarkable that you're out there, because I understand that you farm in Carlisle River, which was impacted yesterday by the fires down there in the southwest.
Yeah, it was, sadly. Yep, I was up here, you know, organising all this, and unfortunately one of the firefighters that I know very well, he rang me and said, mate, I'm sorry, but look, I'm a lot luckier than other people. My house isn't burnt, so, you know, that's a bit of a blessing, but everything else is gone. So, look, at the end of the day, there's a lot more people worse off than what I am. My horses are fine. I'm not quite sure about the cattle because they took off through the bush when the fencing went, but fingers crossed they make their way home. And I still can't get in there at the moment because I'm up here. I'm just going to Longwood now. I've had a lot of donations from the northeast area, so I'm just going to drop that down here. We've got dog food and vet supplies and bits and pieces, so I'll do that and I'll make my way home and see what little surprises are there for me.
And if people are listening to this and want to help out or donate, what's the best way to do it and what's the best type of support they can offer?
Hay is definitely a plus, and monetary donations. We can, in the car now, I've got 15 visa vouchers for people. They've lost their homes, they've lost their car, they've lost everything. So, you know, if we can help them get a bit of diesel for the tractor or, you know, a bit of food, that is the best way we can go about it at this point.
Linda Whitter from Aussie Hay Runners speaking with Jared Whittaker. And Linda there still helping even when her place has been burnt. And we've seen so many in that same situation as well. A lot of firefighters are having to go back to their own burnt properties. And we've been thinking of everyone in Victoria that has been affected. And for anyone interested in donating, you can find out more on the Aussie Hay Runners Facebook page. And, you know, we'll keep following along with these fires as well on the South Australian Country Hour. And we'll let you know further on how you might be able to help those farmers affected as well in those areas. Brooke Neindorf with you. It's 28 minutes past 12. We're running a little bit behind for the weather, but we're joined by Ellie Matthews from the Bureau of Meteorology. Ellie, welcome to the Country Hour.
Thank you, Brooke, for having me. How are you today?
I'm very well, thanks. A little bit of a cooler day across the state today compared to last week. How are things looking across SA?
Yeah, so after we did see that change move through late last week and over the weekend, we have since seen those extensive heatwave conditions easing off into this week. So For today, we've seen a high-pressure ridge continuing to dominate the weather pattern, and generally that is bringing pretty well clear skies across the state, and temperatures sitting somewhere in the mid-20s to 30s across the agricultural areas today, and reaching in the mid to high 30s across the pastoral districts. So after that, we did have those record-breaking heat waves conditions during last week, with some records broken for some areas. But today, settled conditions, clear skies, the winds sitting generally a broad south to southeasterly, starting to become more moderate to fresh about the coast, with some afternoon sea breezes kicking in. And really the trend into tomorrow is very similar, as this high pressure system continues to dominate, with dry conditions once again continuing into tomorrow and expecting mostly sunny skies. We will start to see the temperatures warming up into the middle of the week. So into tomorrow, we will start to see a couple of degrees added to most forecast temperatures until we get to Wednesday, which is expected to be the warmest of the days upcoming. That is ahead of what will be a slight shift in the weather, in terms of we'll see some showers developing about parts of the southeast or southern coasts and southern and central coasts into later Wednesday and continuing into Thursday. That's as a new high pressure system comes in from the west and we see a trough that deepens over Victoria. So that will start to enhance some of the southeasterly winds over the state and start to bring that little bit of moisture about some parts of the southern and central coasts there. So by the time we get into Wednesday, Thursday and even Friday, we could see some very isolated showery conditions through those parts. Not expected to bring too much more than 2 to 3 millimetres over the accumulated period there to the end of Friday. So elsewhere, once those are more fresh southerly winds push through on Thursday, we will start to see temperatures dropping down a few degrees into Thursday and Friday, particularly across the agricultural region. So we may see temperatures coming back down, say 3 to 6 degrees for Thursday and even continuing into Friday. But generally, it's quite a settled pattern, particularly until we even get to the weekend, Brooke.
And, like, just before you go, some of those warmer days coming up, are they going to be as extreme as we saw last week, or just sort of a much sort of more comfortable heat?
Look, the warmer of the days, like I said, being that one of Wednesday, it's across the agricultural regions that we could start to see temperatures getting into the mid to high 30s, particularly through the northern agricultural. It's across the pastoral regions that we could see temperatures up into the 40s. But once that cooler change does come through on Thursday and even into Friday, we do see those temperatures dropping even up to, up to that 6 degrees will drop back down into Thursday and Friday. So certainly not expecting to see the widespread heat that we did see last week.
No worries. Ellie, thanks for your time on the Country Hour today.
Thank you, Brooke.
That was Ellie Matthews from the Bureau of Meteorology, and Brooke Neindorf with you today. Let's have a quick look at the Western Inlands now. For the Upper Western, mostly sunny with a slight chance of a shower in the southeast, near zero chance elsewhere, and the chance of a thunderstorm in the south in the late afternoon and evening. Wind southeast to southwesterly, 20 to 30 kilometres per hour, tending north to northeasterly in the morning, then tending southeast to southwesterly, 15 to 25 kilometres per hour in the middle of the day. Overnight temperatures falling to 21 to 27, with daytime temperatures reaching around 40. For the Lower Western, mostly sunny with a slight chance of a shower in the far east, near zero chance elsewhere, and the chance of a thunderstorm in the northeast in the late afternoon and evening. Wind southerly 15 to 25 k's per hour, overnight temperatures falling to between 16 and 22, with daytime temperatures reaching 35 to 40. Brooke Neindorf with you. It's 27 minutes to 1.
The 2026 Australian Open. Hear it live and ad-free on ABC Sport Digital and take it with you on the ABC Listen app.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Brooke Neindorf with you for the Country Hour today and for the rest of this week. So make sure you stay tuned. Cassie Huff will be back with you as of next week. But coming up the next 25 minutes or so, a new non-destructive leaf scanning method has been developed by researchers at the University of Adelaide, which will be able to accurately predict cannabis crop potency without destroying the plant.
The way it's been done previously required you to destructively sample the plant. So you would have to, like, physically remove a flower and measure the reflectance of the flower itself. So this is the first time that a truly non-destructive method has been developed for this application.
We'll have more on that story very shortly. Very interesting, that one. But first, let's get the latest from the newsroom with Matt Coleman. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Brooke. In the news this afternoon, a Palestinian-Australian writer who was dropped from the Adelaide Writers' Week program says she'll definitely attend if the decision is reversed. Dr. Runda Abdul Fattah was cancelled after the board decided it would not be culturally sensitive to have her on the program so soon after the terrorist attack at Bondi Beach. Many writers have quit the festival in protest. A former Broken Hill station owner has put up his hand to help Victorian farmers affected by bushfires. Livestock agents in Euroa put out a call for donations of freight and fodder to feed stock that survived the fires in Victoria. Deniliquin farmer Wes Herring says he wants to give back after receiving support during droughts in Broken Hill in 2017 to 2023. And SA Labor says it will make fertility treatment more accessible and affordable if it's re-elected in March. A $2,000 rebate for out-of-pocket costs for up to two IVF cycles will be available for those with a household income of $180,000 or less, among other eligibility criteria. Labor says it will invest $18.5 million over 4 years to deliver the scheme. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks very much, Matt. Matt Coleman in the newsroom. Now, we just heard there about some donations starting to come forward for those battling with those Victorian bushfires. And when former grazier Wes Herring needed help during the recent drought, it was farmers from Victoria who turned up at his station near Broken Hill with loads of hay and support. Now, Wes is now based near Deniliquin, and he's now returning the favour to those who have lost everything in those Victorian fires. Livestock agents in Euroa put the call out for donations of freight and fodder to feed stock that had survived, with Wes delivering his first donation to Longwood on Sunday.
You know, they give what they could at the time. And one of the biggest things, as you know, in Australia is freight. You know, it's all very well for people to say, you know, I've got hay, you can have it, you just need to get it. And that was exactly what happened here in our local area when the local agent, Nutrien, Bill O'Brien, put the call out for some hay. And then he said, would you happen to be able to shift it? So we organised that, and within 2 hours we had a B double load organised and a contribution from two prestation up at Oxley. He made up there, Chris the manager, made a donation and paid for the fuel to shift it. So yeah, we got in there yesterday about 2 o'clock with 51 bales of hay. So.
And Wes, look, we've seen it on our social media feeds and on the television, but just to see that landscape, but it's something that most of us would never witness. But just that charcoal blackened landscape must just break the hearts of the people living in that part of the world.
I've had an extremely heavy feeling within myself since being there yesterday. I had a pretty rough night last night. I honestly don't know how they're doing it, mate. I mean, the way we were meant to go in, we couldn't because a fire had flared up, so we were diverted down these back roads and got in, so we missed a lot of the fire ground because it was still active. But where we unloaded was right on the edge of the Hume Freeway, and it was closed. They closed it again while we were there unloading due to a flare-up and a big tree come down and shut the southbound lanes. But I was literally, I don't know, a quarter of a mile from the fire ground. Like, you could see it, you could smell it, you could almost hear it, and it was just a complete eeriness. And the people down there, like, there was you know, farmers basically waiting with body trucks to try and feed what stock is left alive that they can keep. But yeah, as I said to Christina, mate, they're running on adrenaline, or I don't know what they're running on at the moment, but it's going to be a complete horror story once it in the next week or so, once it all starts to come back to reality.
And when you pulled up, Wes, and they started to unload, what sort of response and reaction were you getting from those people?
Oh, mate, they were, you know, there was a couple of other trucks in front of me, smaller trucks. Obviously, that's all they had, but to see that B-double roll in, yeah, they were certainly most appreciative and made a few blokes smile. And the local elders' girls rushed out with, you know, coffee and food and whatever they could give us to sort of thank us. And, yeah, they just couldn't do enough. And just grateful.
putting these fires out's one thing, Wes, but the need of these people is going to continue on, I would imagine, right through 2026. It's not going to go away once the fires are out.
Mate, there's... No, look, that's the first thing. I mean, they got to get them out for a start. And, you know, like I was saying to Erin yesterday on our way down, you know, in the, you know, droughts up there, as you know, we get dust storms and that, and your fences get covered and you clear them with the grader and the loader and they get flooded and they get pushed over and you get out there with side-by-sides and whatever you can to stand them back up. But once they're burnt, they're buggered. Like, you, I mean, I went to Myrtleford after the King Lake fires and on and done a week's fencing for farmers, and they're just, it's buggered, like it's rooted, so every bit of infrastructure they have is no good. So, and you know, some people were lucky that they, well, not lucky I suppose is the word, but fortunate enough that, you know, they were able to save a shed or a tractor or something, whereas others have lost completely everything. All they have is basically their boots and their hat and a shirt and their back.
And to go back into those farms, and if you have lost infrastructure, but the loss of stock, I mean, that would really cut them to the quick, wouldn't it?
Well, and that's what the biggest thing is now, is they're calling for donations or available ammunition, because they've actually run out to put stock down. That's how many stock is lost. And the number will be a while before they know, because Victoria, especially that part of Victoria, has such good stocking rates for the land, as it's very productive land. It's going to be a huge blow to the farming community of Victoria and Australia in a whole. It's going to take a massive amount of stock out of the picture.
Well, Wes, you've done your bit, and I mean, I suppose all the payment you needed was to see the looks on those faces and people saying thank you.
Absolutely, mate, and they're still putting hay together, so as soon as there's another load, we'll be back down there again. The locals are doing what they can, and yeah, people around, and yeah, it's great to see that, you know, it was organised by Nutrien here in Deniliquin through Elders in Euroa, and then you get to you get down there, and all three agents, there's no one's above anyone. They're just all working together to do what they can for the men and women of rural Victoria.
Former grazier Wes Herring from Deniliquin speaking with Andrew Schmidt, and talking there about dropping off some donations of freight and fodder to Victoria there as they battle those fires. You can stay tuned and updated live on a ABC website, abc.net.au. There's a live blog happening at the moment, and we'll keep you up to date over the next few days and weeks and months, no doubt, of anything that South Australian farmers and locals can do to help those affected by those current bushfires. Brooke Neuendorf with you. It's 18 minutes to 1.
Keep the kids entertained these school holidays with screen-free entertainment on the ABC Listen app, like Bluey Book Reads.
Bluey's not sure what to play.
And the Road Trip Podcast.
A boing, a boing, boing.
Find these podcasts and more in the Kids tab on the ABC Listen app.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Our grain growers across South Australia who have either finished harvest or are hopefully on the home stretch. But due to the drought and low prices in the grain market, many farmers are deciding it's better to cut their crop for hay. For Alex McGorman, who runs Thornby at Sanderston on the Murray Plains, the decision to cut more hay has set up supply for their lamb feedlot. And he says they did have a late finish to harvest.
We finished on Tuesday, so was it 7th, which is very much late for us. We actually started on the 31st of October, but the season wasn't with us as far as crops ripening.
Yeah, some people have said it was really a shocker of a season, and it feels like a recovering from a hangover of something you never want to see again. Now, what was the season like for you?
Ours started, as everybody else in the state, with no rain until the break, which was right at the start of June sort of thing. We did actually get quite a good break on our country near the foothills. We're based at the base of the Mount Lofty Ranges, going out probably about 10 k's. The first 5 kilometres out was quite reasonable, and the last 5 kilometres was pretty ordinary.
Were you able to do anything a bit different this year in terms of your programs to make things work in such a tough year?
We did end up cutting a bit more down for hay, because at one stage with this, when the rain stopped in August and September, our wheat crops and a couple of barley crops didn't think we were going to finish, so we cut them down. The oats was looking really good, but it wouldn't push out, so that got cut well, it was always going to be cut down, but it was a short but thick crop. And we did actually 500 acres of barley. We didn't bother reaping. We put the sheep on. And that was due mainly to the late rains where the further out crops, they almost died and come back. And that's still green at this point. Some of those country will put the sheep on because of the late November rains, which, yeah, were just too late for us, really.
Yeah, you mentioned cutting a bit more for hay. It feels like, yeah, it felt like I was seeing many more bales and baling happening around than maybe previous years. But yeah, I guess with some of the drought, you know, has there still been plenty of demand and homes for it?
We needed to. Last year we ended up buying hay out of Queensland, Northern Territory, Victoria and New South Wales just to get through with a land feedlot. This year we're, you know, pretty determined to make as much hay as we could. The season was with us and, we've got enough to supply ourselves. So it's a big saving being able to make it all ourselves and not cart it in from all over the state. And yeah, everybody's southeastern Australia, everybody's sheds are empty. So yeah, the whole area needed a big hay cut and luckily we got it. A lot of the later areas end up with wet hay, so maybe there's some quality issues out there, but there is a lot of hay out there now.
And I guess that's been probably a silver lining and a good option for people that hay is so needed if people are getting, have had issues having the quality there for their grain or maybe, I've heard some of the issues with the pricing, people talking about 1990s pricing in the markets.
Yeah, I was just looking we don't deliver much, but deliver a bit of wheat. Yeah, 2 days ago, I look at the cash prices, geez, that's not really on. And, as far as, farmers coming off a tough year, and if you haven't got much to sell and you look at those prices compared, to silo prices are getting 270, 280 for wheat, and you're paying, I think, 1200 on what the fertiliser price is coming in around about next year. It's doesn't really add up very well.
How does this year compare to previous years? Your family have been in the game for six generations and you've been on your property for four generations?
We've had a really average run just here. I think it's our best year actually since 2016. 2016 was a bumper. That was really good. Snuck for a few other years, but they're probably, within that 5Ks of the hills, probably the best year we've had there. Not no huge crops or anything, but pretty reasonable and pretty solid all the way through.
And I imagine you'd be glad to have finished up with the dust storms coming in again late this week. Did you get many of the earlier dust storms in the season affecting any of your crops or topsoil?
Lucky enough, yeah, the early dust storms, winds, a lot of our country, we actually dry sowed 90-95% of it, and the last got sowed very quickly after the break of the season. So our country covered pretty well. So we didn't have much blowing. The few little ridges we do, we're actually out and next week starting spreading manure over them and having the lamb feedlot, sand ridges that are blowing, we just spread manure on them and that sort of holds them up.
And, how are things going with your lambing operation? Obviously tough with some of the heat, but, you're used to tough summers.
Yeah, it's the lamb feedlot, we just buy in lambs, and they're going quite well. They've made it through this heat wave pretty well without much drama at all. Just got to make sure, most pens are shaded and then just checking that water. Water's critical at the moment, and we're keeping one hell of an eye on the water during this sort of heat wave.
And what's 2026 looking like for you guys?
Well, done a fair bit of summer spraying already, making sure we control our melons and skeleton weed and that sort of stuff. Probably be a similar type program. In this area, trying to grow your break crops is a bit risky. Our lentils and canola, they were a bit disappointing. More so on the quality. We didn't have any test weight in our canola. We're still holding on to that because it's undeliverable to Viterra standards. So there's working out what we're going to be doing there a bit more. But, yeah, going probably with a strong hay program, maybe even looking at putting a few more paddocks into vetch and that, and maybe running a few breeding ewes potentially, or just feeding some more lambs just to lessen the risk, depending on the break of the season.
Alex McGorman from Thornby at Sanderston on the Murray Plains speaking with Eliza Burlage. Now, big news in the world of medicinal cannabis in Australia, with two of the country's main industry groups teaming up. After government feedback highlighted the challenges of dealing with multiple groups, the Australian Medicinal Cannabis Association and Medicinal Cannabis Industry Australia have decided to merge. This month, they'll officially become the Medicinal Cannabis Council of Australia. Teresa Nicoletti, the chair of the AMCA, says the merger means the industry will have one strong united voice, making it easier to advocate for key players, including growers.
Historically, AMCA, the Australian Medicinal Cannabis Association, has covered industry representatives, healthcare professionals and patient advocates, whereas Medicinal Cannabis Industry Association was predominantly industry-based. In any event, the two associations were very much aligned, and more so in the past year, in the objectives and how they saw the sector evolving. And so that led to quite a bit more collaboration between the two associations. Feedback from government was that it was much more difficult for government to speak to multiple associations, and their preference was also that the sector speak with one voice. So that really led to the imperative for the two associations to merge. And so it took maybe 3 months to negotiate the terms of the deed of merger and then the constitution as well. And then that was circulated to the directors of both boards and then finalised just before Christmas, and then the deed of merger was executed before Christmas. There's a few additional legal steps to achieve completion, and certainly by the end of this month, the two associations will cease to exist independently. It will be Medicinal Cannabis Council Australia.
How is the industry overall travelling?
It's growing very rapidly, but the only thing I'll say is that the rapid growth has been more related to the importation of products from overseas. And so whilst that part of the sector has flourished and is increasing all the time, I don't think we've done enough to enable our domestic industry. And part of the reason for that is our regulatory system in Australia is very stringent. It makes it a lot more difficult and costly for Australian companies to cultivate, produce and manufacture medicinal cannabis products. And the result of that is that imported products are much cheaper and faster to place on the market.
So places like Canada may have a more relaxed system, and it's easier to just bring it over here than the costs and restrictions that growers face here.
Correct. And the majority of our products that are imported are coming from Canada.
And so how do you try and tackle that without putting tariffs and other things in place?
Yes, it's a good question. And the difficulty is that with tens of thousands of scripts issued every month in Australia now, and a large number of patients finding benefit with medicinal cannabis, there is a significant concern about not disrupting access. But at the same time, we want a responsible scheme that considers the best interests of patients first. Australian products are amongst the highest quality in the world, and so it would be helpful if our government provided a scheme that enabled the Australian industry to flourish as well without compromising the quality and safety of products on the market.
Teresa Nicoletti, Chair of the Australian Medicinal Cannabis Association, speaking to Brandon Long about that association and Medicinal Cannabis Industry Australia joining together to become Medicinal Cannabis Council of Australia. Now, just to say the word cannabis again, let's stay with that now. And a new non-destructive leaf scanning method has been developed by researchers at the University of Adelaide, which will be able to accurately predict cannabis crop potency. Developed with a German tech company, the technique will involve taking measurements across a plant's canopy. And researcher Dr. Aaron Phillips says it will first be used on a smaller scale for medicinal cannabis, but could be used on a larger scale for industrial crops. And I spoke with him about the work they've been doing.
In 2022, we started collaborating with an industry partner, and they were interested in developing a medicinal cannabis industry in South Australia. And one of the things that they wanted to know is whether it was possible to predict how potent the cannabis flowers would be prior to harvest. And we have an existing relationship with Compolytics, this German tech company. And so we thought, well, why don't we try and apply Compolytics technology to the question that our industry partner was asking? And yeah, that's how the project came about.
So this couldn't be done before this technique came about?
It could be done, but the way it's been done previously required you to destructively sample the plant. So you would have to like physically remove a flower and measure the reflectance of the flower itself. And of course, every time you damage the plant, you introduce the chance that it will be infected with some kind of disease, or you might change the way that it makes the cannabinoids from the damage that you've done to the plant. So this is the first time that a truly non-destructive method has been developed for this application.
And is this just for medicinal cannabis plants?
No, so it can be applied to any cannabis crop, so that includes industrial hemp. So one application that we see for this technology is farmers being able to, say you've got a field of industrial hemp, you might be able to fly a drone over that crop that has the hyperspectral technology on board. It can scan the crop and give you an indication of whether you've got any plants that are exceeding the legal THC limits that are imposed on industrial hemp growers.
And would that be different, the industrial hemp side be different to how you might use this technique with medicinal cannabis plants?
Yeah, so I guess the scale of the grows are different. So in an indoor setting, you've probably got a smaller footprint, so you're more likely going to use a handheld device, which is what this company, this German company Compolytics, develops. It's more feasible to check your plants with a handheld device. Whereas obviously on a farm situation, if you've got acres and acres of crop, you're going to want something like a drone that can capture more information for you faster.
And so, as you said there, using that handheld device, does it just sort of go over the top of the plants to detect what you need to be looking for?
So you can think about it like a barcode scanner that you might see at Coles or Woolies. It fits in your hand. It's got a little clip on the end of it, and you just put the leaf in the leaf clip section and you basically press go and it takes its readings. Those readings are fed into a mathematical model and the device can instantly tell you its prediction for all sorts of cannabinoids.
And does each leaf, is that a different, like a, you know, like a human's fingerprint?
Yeah, so the device works by measuring the wavelengths of light that the leaf reflects. And every leaf will have a different, it's called a spectral profile. Every leaf will have a different spectral profile. And we can use those differences in the spectral profiles to feed into the mathematical models to then determine all sorts of things about the plant.
Why is this technique so important for the cannabis industry?
Well, I guess there's kind of three parts to it. So we've already touched on how it might be important for industrial hemp growers in terms of detecting violations of the THC limits that they're held under. It's also important for medicinal cannabis growers because it can allow them to focus their resources on plants that are predicted to be elite performers. So if you're early in a grow cycle, if early on in the grow cycle you can identify plants that are probably not going to give you much bang for your buck, you can eliminate them from your grow, which means that you're saving time and money and resources on those low-performing plants. We also think that it can be used by breeders to help select for plants to help increase overall cannabinoid profiles.
You mentioned there about the industrial hemp growers and those strict THC limits that they've got. Does this save, you know, them having to destroy entire crops?
Yeah, so the idea would be that you identify plants that run hot, so to speak, so plants that exceed the limit, and you can remove them before any kind of regulator comes along to check what's going on in your crop. So at the moment, if any violation of the threshold is detected, your entire crop can be destroyed.
And how long, Aaron, before you might see this being used in the industry?
Oh, good question. The technology is available now in terms of the handheld device, so via Compolytics. We still haven't tested whether you can use the technology on drones, but that's kind of the next stage of the research. So that's still up in the air, but certainly for the handheld applications, the technology is available now.
And have you got to the point where you're obviously happy with how this technology is working and then you can look at those extra options as such as drones into the future?
Yeah, absolutely. So the way that the models are right now, We're very happy with them. So we're getting up to like 89% prediction accuracy, which exceeds previous methods as well. But yeah, definitely excited to extend the work into the drone territory.
It's a very interesting research happening there at the University of Adelaide. That was researcher Dr. Aaron Phillips. That's all we've got time for on the Country Hour for today. You can check out more great stories online at abc.net.au/rural. I'll be back with you at the same time tomorrow. It's coming up to news time. It's 1 o'clock.
Join Charlie Pickering for a news update like no other.
Aren't you busy watching the news so I don't have to?
Why? The Weekly, back Wednesday, January 14, straight after Hard Quiz on ABC TV and
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.